Laurie's out there.
Hold on.
Laurie, the boogeyman is outside. Look.
The Oscar goes to.
And the Grammy goes to.
The winner is.
The winner is.
The winner is.
The winner is.
The winner is. The winner is.
And the winner is.
What's it like to send your luggage?
Sometimes. That means sometimes.
There can be 100 people in a room. Maybe there is right now.
I know it's tuna, but it says chicken.
I don't know her.
She always has these long lists of, like, diva demands.
Cheetos and Doritos.
Great gowns, beautiful gowns.
I understand you embrace the term diva.
Yes.
Hello, divas and devos. Welcome back to another episode of Diva Dailies. This is a podcast where we deconstruct divas on film and TV. I'm your host, Steffi. And this week we have, I would say he's like our horror expert correspondent for this month. It's Stefan.
Hello, everybody. And thank you for giving me that title, Steffi. I'm very flattered.
I mean, well, now would be the perfect time to segue. What's your social media handle for people who don't know?
Yeah, Scream Forever One.
Yeah, so I mean, like, based on your Twitter handle, I think you can kind of assume huge horror fan. And I feel like for the next couple weeks is probably going to be guiding me through these horror movies.
Can't wait.
Okay, well, before we get into it, just want to do some housekeeping business. If you aren't already, if you want to follow the podcast, we're at Diva Dailies Pod on Instagram and Twitter. You can also email us divadailiespod@gmail.com. And you can leave us a voicemail. We're 714-729-3121. And if you wouldn't mind giving us a nice little rating and review, especially if you're listening on the Apple Podcast app, that would be greatly appreciated. So let's just jump into it. Our first segment that we do for every single episode, it's our Oscar and Razzie moment of the week. This is a segment where we talk about our personal high point and low point moments of the week. So Stefan, what's going on? What's up?
Yeah, my Oscar moment of the week is one of the best movies I've seen so far of 2020. This maybe will change, but so far one of them is The Invisible Man.
Okay, yeah.
Would love to review that for this podcast sometimes if you ever do an Elizabeth Moss.
I mean, I love Elizabeth Moss. I love Handmaid's Tale, so.
Yeah, no, it's incredible, and it just came out on home video finally. I bought it the other day on DVD. Yeah, I'm old school. I know. I take pride in my physical collection.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I love physical copies too. I think it's like a lost thing now, especially in the age of digital. So that's cool.
Between my roommate and I, we have probably upwards of 1,000 DVDs together.
Oh, wow. That's quite the collection.
Yeah.
That's really cool though.
Yeah. And so I bought it and, the first night, watched it with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
They really liked it.
Oh, nice. That's really good.
I hope you see it by the time this episode drops.
You know, if it wasn't for the whole corona situation, I'm sure I have a friend who she and I, we usually like go out and watch a horror movie together. Like that's kind of our thing. So I'm sure we would have made our way to the movie theater to watch it. But yeah. I've heard good things about it.
If I ever do make it out to California and there's like some big horror movie plan, I'd love to tag along. It'd be fun.
Yeah, for sure. Well, what's your Razzie moment of the week?
My Razzie moment is being in Minnesota, the murder by police of George Floyd.
Yeah.
It's murder.
Mm-hmm.
Footage is there. The proof is in the pudding. And
yeah,
the situation is just spiraling out of control. Parts of Minneapolis are on fire, literally.
Wow.
There's looting everywhere. It's out of control. You know, I used to live not too far from there. My ex-boyfriend of mine, still a good friend, lives even closer. And I checked in with him. He's doing fine. But it's just very scary to know that that's happening. That both things, the injustice, the murder by police, and the riot and looting is happening so close to my home.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, I'm seeing the developments on social media. I try to not spend too much time on social media. You can like really spend a lot of time there and then you end up not getting anything done. But especially now in recent days, in the recent past like 24, 48 hours, because it's a very heavy place to be right now for sure. But yeah.
Definitely.
Well, I mean, Razzie Moment of the Week is, I was going to say similar thing, but Oscar moment of the week is that I got a lot of work done last night. So me, I'm personally proud of myself for being productive. Additional Oscar moment of the week is I'm happy that I finally got around to watching Halloween, which is the movie we're going to be talking about today.
Movie you're about to review.
I know. Yeah. Yes, we're about to talk about it in 0.5 seconds. So let's segue into actually talking about the movie now.
And now, our feature presentation.
Halloween night. A small American town. 15 years ago.
The movie that we're going to be talking about today is Halloween.
I think he'll come back.
Exploring uncharted territory.
Been totally charted.
Just talk.
Sure, sure.
The only reason she babysits is to have a...
Halloween.
And this was an independent film, which I did not know, but it was an indie film released on October 25th, 1978. I read here specifically in Kansas City, Missouri, but then after being acquired from Aquarius Releasing, it had a wider regional release in major cities a couple weeks after. So, Halloween. 15 years after murdering his sister on Halloween night in 1963, Michael Myers escapes from a mental hospital and returns to the small town of Haddonfield, Illinois to kill again. He starts stalking a babysitter, Laurie Strode, and her friends while unknowingly under the pursuit of his psychiatrist. So Halloween stars our diva of the week, Miss Jamie Lee Curtis. It also stars Toni Morin, Nick Castle, Donald Pleasance, PJ Souls, Nancy Keys, Charles Cyphers, Brian Andrews, and Kyle Richards. This movie was directed by John Carpenter, and the screenplay is by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill. And I found here that Deborah Hill was also the producer of the movie, and I guess at the time, she and John Carpenter were dating. So, yep. fun fact there.
And also for the writing, so John Carpenter wrote most of Donald Pleasance's lines, and Deborah Hill wrote most of the dialogue between the female characters.
Oh, interesting. Well, opening question then, when was the first time you saw this movie?
Okay, you're going to hate me for saying this, but I honestly do not remember when I first saw this movie.
Oh, no, it's okay.
I was... probably a teenager. I'd see bits and pieces of it so much over the years that it kind of just felt like I had seen the whole thing. But I have seen the whole thing, though, when I was about 20, I would say.
Yeah. And do you remember what your initial impressions were of the movie, like when you first watched it? Were you like, oh, this is good? Or I don't know. What did you think?
I mean, I knew how groundbreaking it was. And I can definitely see why it was so groundbreaking.
Yeah.
You know, it's very tame. Mm-hmm. For today, especially in terms of blood and gore, especially with one of the other movies we're going to be reviewing, you know, this month. But it still, you know, delivers great suspense and scares with amazing performances, especially by Jamie Lee Curtis.
Absolutely. And then I guess for me, I'm going to be honest. First time I watched this movie, literal hours ago, before having to record for this podcast.
There you go.
I mean, obviously, you know, I know of the movie. Hello. I just never got around to watching it. If anything, I was always very familiar with the score. But yeah, I mean, initial impressions after I watched it, I was like, wow, this is really good. I could definitely see why and how it's considered a classic. And even though I don't dabble too much in the horror genre, but from what I've personally watched, I can see how those things reference Halloween and like where it came from. What's your first scene? Because my first scene is the very beginning.
Same.
Okay, perfect. Okay, so let's do this together then.
Okay.
Like we just said, Stefan and I's first scene is the opening sequence. It's Halloween night, 1963, and this is essentially kind of Michael Myers' first kill. It's better if you just like seek out this scene, if anything, but I'm going to try my best to describe the scene right now. So basically, it's shot from the point of view of someone, and we don't know who that someone is, but we first see like a house, and then we get closer to the house, and it's all diegetic sound, and then we peek through the side window, and we see this teenage girl and teenage guy, and they're kind of about ready to start fooling around a bit, and it's a bit, you know, creepy, voyeuristic. And then this is when we get our first bit of real dialogue in the movie, and it's our first mention of Michael.
We are alone, aren't we?
Michael's around someplace.
You know, at this point, we don't know who Michael is, but we're just like, okay, little piece of information. I'm going to save that in the back of my head. Then the camera goes around the house and we see the lights turn off upstairs. And we get this sound effect that, by the way, when I watched this, because I had the speaker like right next to my ear, I like jumped because I was like, oh my God, I was not expecting that sound effect. So then we make our way inside the empty first floor. The score starts to creep in. And then we see a hand reach for this knife. Another piece of information is like, okay, we're reaching for the knife. We see the teenage boy leave. We go up these really narrow stairs. And we see ourselves reach for this mask. And then our view gets a bit obscured because we're looking at everything through the holes of the mask. We walk inside a room and we see this teenage girl. And she recognizes us and she says,
Michael!
And then it's like, boom, another piece of information. We're Michael. And then we start to stab her to death. We walk downstairs. Outside, we're greeted by two adults. One of them says,
Michael?
And they pull off the mask and then cut to, we're no longer in the point of view anymore. And we see that Michael is a young boy. And I was like, whoa, what a way to open your movie. First 5 minutes of Halloween. That's great. What were your thoughts?
Yes, I agree with everything you said. I love the detail you describe. I mean, I know you just watched this movie. Is there a copyright infringement that you can't upload any of it?
No, I mean, I was trying to be as descriptive as possible because I'm trying to think, like, if I were to edit that into the podcast, uh-huh. I'm not quite sure if the sound effects more or less would be able to do it justice because that's such a visual opening sequence. But thank you. I tried my best there. I pretty much wrote everything down word for word there. But what did you like about this particular sequence?
I always have loved found footage horror from the point of view.
Okay.
I thought that was just brilliant done, especially with the mask.
Yeah.
You really felt like you were there.
Yeah.
It answers some questions, but not all.
Yes.
And it just leaves you wondering so much for what is to come.
You see this play throughout the entire film, but I feel like what John Carpenter does really well, but especially in this sequence, is he knows how to build suspense. He establishes the tension between what information we know, but also what information we don't know. And it's that middle piece of the Venn diagram that's where the tension and the fear lies. And it's like how and when he gives us those little pieces of information that makes this particular sequence really, really well done. Because I mean, like, the entire time you're kind of like, oh, okay, like, who's Michael? What's really going on? But like the big, like, oh my gosh moment is when it's that like reveal of like, oh, Michael's a kid. I was like, whoa, I didn't know. Because I really did not know anything too much about like the plot of Halloween. So when it was like, this is pretty much the origin story of Michael Myers right here, I was like, whoa. That's crazy.
Definitely.
You know, I was reading online too. It was an interesting critique that I read that because the introduction of this movie is literally from the point of view of the villain, some people were saying that this encourages sadism and misogyny with audiences because it encourages audiences to literally identify with the villain. Have you heard of that critique regarding Halloween before?
Yeah, I mean, I have heard that. And, you know, slasher movies, we could spend a whole episode talking about, you know, slasher movies and, in my opinion, alleged misogyny.
Okay.
This is something that my mom and I, yeah, hi mom, you're probably going to be listening to this.
Yeah.
This is something she and I butted heads with over a lot when my sister and I were kids.
Mm-hmm.
About the treatment of women in these movies and women being helpless and butchered. And later in this episode, we're going to talk about The Final Girl.
Yeah.
And when we do another movie later this month, we'll talk about it more. And it's good to kind of compare the two because it's two kind of eras of the genre.
Yeah. Well, Stefan, what's your first scene then? Your second scene, because that was essentially your first scene.
Second scene is when Laurie and Annie are driving in the car when they're smoking the joint.
Yeah.
And Don't Fear the Reaper comes on.
Uh-huh.
You still spooked?
I wasn't spooked.
Lies.
I wasn't. Saw somebody standing in Mr. Riddle's backyard.
Probably Mr. Riddle.
He's watching me.
Mr. Riddle was watching you? Lori, Mr. Riddle is 87.
He can still watch.
First of all, that's one of my favorite songs of all time.
Uh-huh, nice.
I could kick myself for not seeing Blue Oyster Cult for free at the Douglas County State Fair, which is right across the bridge from Duluth in Wisconsin.
Okay.
About, like, 2007, I think they were there. Oh my God, I could kick myself for not going to that. But anyways, just what that scene sets up. And there's another tie-in again. And I hate to leave everyone in suspense and hanging, but it ties into one of the other movies we're going to be reviewing this month too.
Ooh, okay. I can't wait. Well, I need to keep my ears open then when I watch those other two movies.
And I just think that scene does a good job setting up kind of the relationship between Laurie and Annie.
Yeah.
I get the feeling that they're really good friends.
Mm-hmm.
It makes what happens later on, you know, much more tragic.
Hi, Annie. Lori.
Hi, Dad. What happened?
What?
What happened?
Oh, somebody broke into the hardware store. Probably kids.
You blame everything on kids.
Well, now all they took was some Halloween mask, rope, and a couple of knives. Who do you think it was?
It's hard growing up with a cynical father.
What are your thoughts on her friends? Like, how do you feel about Lori's friends?
I'd like to think they would be friends. You know, people like that could be friends in real life at that age.
Mm-hmm.
But you just kind of never know. I mean, Lori wasn't really, I mean, she maybe would be considered a geek, but not really much, I guess. I mean, because we know it's Jamie Lee Curtis, you know, watching it today.
Yeah.
And, you know, they seem to accept her. So I thought it was nice.
Yeah, that is an interesting point you make about us kind of watching this now with the knowledge of, because I feel like, you know, Jamie Lee Curtis doesn't really have that persona of being like a weak, kind of demure, quiet girl. I came across an interview she had done, and she even said herself that when she read the script and she was kind of thinking of like, okay, who can I potentially like audition for and whatnot, she actually identified more with, I believe it was Annie.
I was a young actress and there were three parts for a girl, obviously the smart aleck, the young virgin, and the cheerleader. I thought I would have been like a really good smart aleck, and I was a cheerleader. And yet John, I auditioned, I think, three or four times for Lori. I remember getting it.
I always, for me, kind of felt like watching the dynamic of these three girls. It's like, first of all, I have to remember, they're in high school. So Lori kind of was like, well, these two girls are somewhat nice to me and they pay attention to me. So I guess I'll call them my friends because they're kind of like, I don't know. That's another like major theme of the movie too. Like they kind of always pick at her for being, they call her like a girl scout, but essentially being like a goody two shoes virgin girl. Whereas Annie and Linda are like out here fooling around with their guys and drinking beer, so.
What's the pumpkin for?
I brought it for Tommy. I figured carving a jack-o'-lantern would keep him occupied.
I always said you'd make a fabulous Girl Scout.
Thanks.
Yeah, and when they would, you know, kind of poke fun at her, it wasn't malicious, you know?
Yeah.
Like, just among friends, yeah, which was really nice.
You know, you could ask somebody.
Well, I couldn't.
Sure you could. All you have to do is go up to somebody and say, you want to go to the dance?
You could do that. I couldn't.
Well, you could ask Dick Baxter. He'd go out with you.
I'd rather go out with Ben Tramer.
Ben Tramer? I knew it! See, you do think about things like that, huh, Lori?
Shut up.
He's cute! Ben Tramer!
Okay, so my second scene, this is, you're gonna like die at the reason why I brought this up. Okay, so my second scene is when Annie, one of Lori's best friends, she gets stuck in a window. And basically, Annie has to babysit this young girl, and her name is Lindsay Wallace. And at one point, Annie's babysitting Lindsay Wallace, and Lindsay Wallace is just like, you know, minding her business, watching TV in the dark for like some odd reason, but she likes to do that, I guess. And at one point, Annie goes to the laundry room to the side of the main house because she like got her clothes a little dirty, and she accidentally locks herself in the laundry room because she's a dumbass, and she tries crawling through the window, and she ends up having to call little Lindsay Wallace for help.
Oh, Lindsay, get the phone, it's Paul!
Hello?
Hi, Lindsay. This is Paul. Is Annie there?
Yes, she is.
Get her for me, will you?
She's washing her clothes.
Look, just tell her it's me, okay?
Okay. You locked yourself in.
I know!
And the reason why I picked this scene was because, oh my god, it's Kyle Richards.
Yep.
I'm not the richest girl in Beverly Hills, but I am the luckiest.
I don't think I've ever mentioned this on the podcast, but I love Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. I have been watching that since day one, season one, episode one. I was in front of the TV, like, let's go. Kyle Richards, she's on Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. And it's so funny because at the time that we're recording this, Real Housewives of Beverly Hills is still airing. And at the beginning of this season, the first couple of episodes, Kyle was kind of not in the episode as much because she was filming for one of the Halloween sequels.
Oh, the cat's out of the bag. I was gonna...
Oh, you were gonna reveal.
Yeah, in case nobody knows that already.
Oh,
yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
In the episode, she'll literally be like, oh, I'm so busy, I'm so frazzled because I have to fly to so-and-so to film for Halloween. Like, she's very proud that she's part of that franchise. So I'm just like, wow, it's here. Like, I'm watching little Kyle Richards, and I was just like, I'm happy I'm having this moment now. So, yeah.
I'm scared.
Why are you sitting here with all the lights off?
I don't know.
Well, come on, get your coat. We're going to pick up Pa.
I don't want to.
Look, Lindsay, I thought we understood each other.
I want to stay here and watch this.
Okay. Well, if I can fix it so you can watch TV with Tommy Doyle, would you like that?
Yeah.
Well, come with me.
It's so funny. She still, like, kind of looks the same.
I love when you look at actors in their first roles.
Yeah.
And then where they end up, it's like, how do they feel about how they ended up? Do they expect to end up that way?
Mm.
And did we expect them to end up that way? You know, I wonder the young stars of today, like, you know, where they'll be in 30 years, like Jennifer Lawrence.
Yeah.
Will she be like the next Meryl Streep in that sense, you know?
I mean, Jennifer Lawrence has already achieved
yeah.
quite a bunch in her young life. But yeah, I mean, as far as Kyle Richards is concerned, based off of what they've shown us on Real Housewives, she is very proud to be part of the Halloween franchise. Like, that is a badge of honor for her. Like, I was actually really surprised that, like, I mean, she's like obviously not the main character in Halloween, but I was surprised at how large of a role she played in the plot, because, like, sometimes, you know, Housewives fans, we know that the girls tend to over dramatize quite a bit. So I was thinking, like, watch, Kyle is probably like only in a scene and she is saying this is her movie, blah blah blah, but I was like, oh wait, she's actually in a decent amount. So
yeah,
I was really surprised. I get it, Kyle.
And I think 42 years between the two movies, that's a long time to reprise the same role and have the same actor, actress do it.
Yeah. For some reason, like, seeing how young Kyle was in this movie in relation to Jamie Lee, I was like, wow, that is quite an age difference.
Yeah.
I don't know why I kind of always picture them to be, like, not too far off in age. But I'm like, she's a literal child next to Jamie Lee Curtis.
Was she like, was she about eight?
Yeah, I think so.
I always have that memory of me on the last day of shooting with you carrying me all the way back to my dressing room.
Yeah.
And I never forgot that. So I have a lot of great memories
of
that.
I have beautiful memories of you.
Do you watch the other Real Housewives shows?
I mean, Beverly Hills is the one that I have consistently kept up with. I've watched a handful of, like, Atlanta. I've watched a handful of Jersey. And I've watched a handful of New York. Surprisingly, I never watched Orange County. I've had a lot of people say, you need to get into Orange County. But I'm like, girl, that was the first Real Housewives. I feel like the ship has left the dock a long, long time ago. It's a little too late for me to play catch up at this point. But I dabble a little bit here and there. I know the latest, well, maybe not like the latest, but there was a point where, like, Potomac was the one everyone was like, oh my God, you need to watch Potomac. I never ended up watching Potomac. But I mean, you don't watch the Real Housewives Do you? I don't think you do.
I don't. Yeah. I don't. And I was going to ask the famous GIF.
Oh, there's a lot.
The one where it's like the split where like the blonde woman is like screaming and pointing and then the cat.
Oh, and Kyle's in it.
That's Kyle and holding her back.
Yes, that's Kyle holding her back.
Oh, I love it.
You Stop. Have no idea what she's done to me. You have no idea what she has done.
You're part of the biggest meme on the internet. I mean, how has that been for you? Do people recognize you from the woman yelling at a cat meme?
It's the craziest thing. By the way, I still don't get it. Like, why did that become a thing? I have no idea. Why do they put the cat? I have no idea. I still don't get it.
My third scene, I think, is the same as yours. Is your third scene when Lori learns like her friends are dead and then she starts screaming for help? Is it that sequence or?
Yeah, just that whole scene where like, you know, just bam, 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 like each room she comes into, you know, there's
oh yes
dead body and we see the tombstone.
Okay, so I'll set up the scene then. So basically Lori's friends ditch her and basically dump all of their responsibilities on her to cover for them. So she ends up babysitting both Lindsay Wallace and Tommy. And she goes over to Annie's house because she's basically like, what the fuck is going on? How come no one's calling me back? Also important to note too, that by this point she has ditched the white stockings and now she put on pants because homegirl knows she's probably going to get in a lot of cardio. So let's wear appropriate attire. And she makes her way upstairs and she's greeted basically to a house of horrors.
It's most definitely stop being funny now, cut it out. I'll be sorry.
Where she learns that her two best friends and one of their boyfriends is dead. So. Okay, I'm gonna begin by asking, what was your favorite reveal in this sequence?
The guy, I should remember his name, but the guy like hanging when he swings out of
yes.
when he comes in, that was a big jump scare.
Yeah, I was so surprised by that because I was just like thinking logistically, like, wow, that took thought. Michael Myers, for you to like logistically hang him upside down and have him appropriately like come out when he did. I was like, wow, that's talent.
Yeah, you know, the part where she's hiding in the closet and he's kind of hovering above her like that.
Yeah.
That's the scene that the moral majority and the critics, you know, they pounced on that scene and used that as evidence how the movies, these killers prey upon women.
Oh, okay.
They jumped on that scene and they never let up on that after that.
Oh, interesting.
I've always, and you know, when you talk about the final girl trope, and again, the movie we'll talk about later in the month, maybe even next week, mm-hmm. we'll discuss this more, how women in these movies, the final girl is the one who survives and outsmarts the usually male killer and is the victor in the end and rises up. And I find that very empowering personally.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's interesting that you bring up the concept and idea of the final girl, because when I was doing research, obviously, for this movie, there were some critiques, like I think they were like feminist critiques. Some of them were saying that even though Jamie Lee Curtis's character, she's the last one standing, some people were kind of picking apart, though, like she wasn't necessarily the person who quote unquote killed. Well, first of all, no one kills Michael Myers by the end of this movie, but she wasn't really the one who initially people thought, like, oh, you know, he's dead. Like that psychiatrist was the one who had to essentially shoot Michael Myers until he fell off the balcony. But I've also heard like some other arguments too, saying like the fact that Michael Myers ended up not dying to begin with shows that that argument's a little bit weak. And also the fact that Lori was still able to somewhat injure him shows that, you know, strength.
Oh, absolutely. And I highly recommend watching the sequels to this movie, even though they are basically disregarded now with the new series that is out. Yeah, by the way, did you know that?
Well, okay, so like I was actually a little bit, I mean, this is good that we're bringing this up now. Like, I know there's been a lot of sequels since Halloween, and I think that was kind of the reason why I was a little bit dissuaded from really engaging in the franchise, because I was just like, oh my god, there's like so many. Like, why is there like Halloween H2O? It just like keeps going on and on and on. And I was reading somewhere, like, at one point, they kind of disregarded completely the original story. So that was a bit confusing. But I do know, I think there was, like, a version of Halloween that came out in 2018. And they said, like, that was actually a good sequel of sorts. Yes. So,
and that one effectively ignores all of the sequels.
Okay.
If you happen to have time, the other sequels are not bad. When you get into like 5 or 6, those are not that good. But yeah, 2 is good, and then 3 is unrelated. It's a separate story. They originally they were going to conclude it with 2.
Mm-hmm.
3 was just its own story, and it was going to be like an anthology series where every year it was going to be something different. Originally.
Oh.
But then when that bombed, they brought back Michael Myers in Halloween 4.
Oh. Okay. So
I've been in everyone ever since.
Oh. Well, so then do you recommend, if we've watched Halloween and we liked it, which of the sequels then do you recommend that we watch?
2, H2O, the 2018 Halloween.
Okay. I'll make a note of that then. After, I was going to continue a little bit, after Lori sees that all the people that she pretty much is interacting with for the past couple days is dead, at one point she literally almost gets stabbed. She takes a rough tumble down those stairs, and then she narrowly escapes and manages to run outside, and she starts screaming for her life. And the reason why I want to continue on is because Jamie Lee Curtis is known as the quote-unquote Scream Queen.
Yes.
Help! Somebody help me, please! Somebody help! Oh, God, help me! Please! Please help me! Oh! Oh! Help!
I mean, younger listeners, for those of you guys who watch Scream Queens, that's why it was a really big deal when she got cast in that show, because that was a nod to her being the original Scream Queen.
As someone who is known as the ultimate Scream Queen, did you have to take this show, basically?
You know what? I had to take this show because Ryan Murphy called me up at my house and said, I'd like to meet you.
One of the first things I think I told you, and Brad Falchuk, who was in the meeting too, is like, if you don't do this, we're really not going to do it. Because in some way for me, this show is a tribute to you and your iconic status. And I always feel the thing that you brought to all of your projects, even when you were very young, 17, 18, 19, is you were always very sexy, but you were also a heroine. You were no man's fool. You were nobody's fool.
Just in case, because I do know that there's some listeners that I have that really enjoy Scream Queens.
I'm one of them.
Okay, so you liked Scream Queens.
Yes. The second season kind of went downhill, but the first one I thought was great.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and actually, you know, she kind of coined the term. She didn't self-coin it, but she helped popularize the term Scream Queen, even though there were others before then, including her mother, Janet Lee.
Yes.
In Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
The original Scream Queen is generally considered to be Faye Ray in King Kong.
Okay.
Throw your arms across your eyes and scream, man. Scream for your life!
But you would credit her as kind of, because like, I feel like when you tend to Google Scream Queen, she's usually like the first person that more or less pops up.
Yeah, she's the most popular one, definitely.
Yeah, I mean, she screams quite a bit during the sequence. Mm. I love the part when she's like, the keys! I'm like,
the keys! Oh, the keys!
That was probably like my favorite scream that she had during that sequence. Also, what do you think about her neighbors during this sequence?
Yeah, like
where are they?
Where are they? Yeah, I know.
They don't open their door for her. It's so sad.
Hello, help me! Ma'am, please help me! Please! Can you hear me? Oh God!
And then she like starts yelling at little Tommy, and she throws that flower pot up in the air. I was just like, oh, girl.
Yeah.
Oh, this is rough.
Tommy! Tommy, it's me! Tommy!
But, I mean, she made it through. Well, I have an interesting question for you, though, I guess, before we move on. So, what did you think about... There's been this critique, specifically about, at least this Halloween, that the victims of Michael Myers, they tended to be these, like, young, promiscuous, in most cases, like, women. The first victim he had was his older sister, and we know that she basically hooked up with her boyfriend, and then he killed her. And then Annie was about to hook up with the guy, but then he killed her before she was able to drive off and meet up with him. And then he quite literally kills Linda, I believe is her... the other friend's name. He kills her, like, after she's had sex. Like, there's been that critique, like, John Carpenter specifically wrote this character to kill, I'm quoting, those kinds of promiscuous women, whereas the last woman standing, the final girl, was Jamie Lee Curtis, who's, like, the pure virginal one. Like, do you think that critique is valid, or do you think people were just, like, kind of looking for something?
I mean, it's a common trope. Virgins live, sluts die, generally. And again, I hate to repeat this, but the movie we're going to talk about later this month does explicitly get into this, how, like, only virgins can outsmart the killer. John Carpenter was quoted as saying that he didn't intend that it to be that way, like, to slut shame women. What it was that simply, you know, they were focused on other things, in this case sex, and didn't realize the danger around them. Whereas Lori was able to pick up on it faster and thus kind of prepare mentally in a way.
Okay, I can get with that. Yeah. Well, I mean, is there anything else that you wanted to say about Halloween before we move on?
No, I think we covered it very well.
So let's move on to popcorn and pop stars. This is a segment where we talk about where the diva was at this point in her career when she made the movie. So we're talking about Miss Jamie Lee Curtis here. Stefan, where was Jamie Lee at when she made Halloween?
Well, Halloween was her first movie.
Yes.
She had only done some TV work before. She was, you know, fresh, only about 19, 20. And she was paid only $8,000 to star in this movie.
Oh, crazy.
I know.
Wow.
And the whole movie was made for a budget of only $325,000. And Donald Pleasance, who played Sam Loomis, was a very established actor, and he was only paid $25,000.
Have you ever seen on YouTube, Jamie Lee Curtis did this YouTube video with, I believe it's Variety. They normally sit down with a particular actor or actress, and they ask them to reflect on particular movies that they had done in the past. Have you ever seen that video?
I have not seen the one for Jamie Lee Curtis, but I know that series you're talking about.
Yeah.
It's really wonderful. I've watched the one with Laura Dern.
Oh, of course.
And Jessica Lange.
Yes. Oh, Jessica Lange's is really great.
Hashtag, when are we going to do Jurassic Park, Stephanie?
I know, next season, for sure. But Jamie Lee's, it was really interesting. During that interview, she revealed that, like you said, she was doing TV at the time, and she had gotten fired from that TV sitcom. It was called Operation Petticoat.
Yes.
And had she not gotten fired, she would have not been able to do Halloween.
I was young. I had done a TV series that I had been fired from and thought for sure my career, which was just brand new, was now going to be over. And had I not been fired from Operation Petticoat, I would not have been available to audition for Halloween. Operation Petticoat was canceled, I think, 2 weeks after its second season. And obviously Halloween has given me my entire creative life, so.
And the rest is history.
Yeah. I have also here too that immediately after Halloween, she starred in three more horror movies during this period.
Yes.
So it was The Fog from 1980.
100 years ago, between midnight and one, something unknown came out of the fog. Now it has returned.
Oh, Jesus.
Prom Night from 1980.
Prom Night.
Now!
If you're not back by midnight, you won't be coming home.
And then Terror Train from 1980.
For the students aboard, it's going to be the one party to end them all.
So I kind of feel like she was, you know, pigeonholed a little bit in that genre, but obviously she was able to do more, but, you know.
And I've not seen The Fog, which I've seen the remake to The Fog from 2005. It's dreadful. Yeah, yeah. Don't see it. I have not seen the original, and I really should. Terror Train is okay. I mean, remember, this movie kicked off the golden age of slasher movies from 78 to 84, and they were just a dime a dozen. And let me tell you, these movies, as a kid, I would browse video stores and look at the horror sections, and just they had the most mesmerizing cover art.
Yeah, for sure.
Gaze at them, and I just thought they were so incredible. And my mom was legit concerned because I would, you know, talk about these movies. And I think one of my teachers was like, I was talking about them, and she's like, "Is he watching these movies?" Mm. She's like, "No, he just looks at the cover art." And, you know, child services were not called. So you know,
yeah.
Yeah, no.
Okay, so why do you think Jamie Lee Curtis agreed to do this movie?
I mean, like you said, she just got fired from her show, and as far as I know, she wanted to do a movie.
Yeah, I mean, I'm right there with you. She's like a young actress at the time. It's more or less like, why not? So that's kind of what I had here for that. I have an interesting question for you, though, because like you're like more familiar with the horror genre. Do you think Jamie Lee Curtis, as an actress, how do you think she feels about doing horror movies? Do you think she likes that she's so embraced by the horror community? Or do you think she's kind of like, oh God, another one? How do you think she like feels?
I mean, she keeps coming back to them. She personally has said she does not like horror movies.
Right, like watching them.
Yeah.
There is no amount of money you could pay me to go to a scary movie.
But she must love to make them, and she loves her fan base. She kind of keeps coming back to the genre because she broke out from horror in 1983. She did Trading Places.
No, I am Inga from Sweden.
Sweden? But you're wearing lederhosen.
Yeah, for sure, from Sweden.
And she left, got into that then, and then started doing non-horror films. And she actually was offered, when Halloween 4 was in production, because that came out on the 10th anniversary, 10 years after the original Halloween, she was offered to reprise her role, but she declined.
Oh.
But then returned 10 years later in Halloween H2O.
Oh, okay.
And now she embraces it with Scream Queens and coming back to the Halloween series.
Mm-hmm.
I can picture her doing American Horror Story sometime. I really can. I hope she does.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. That would be so great. I mean, she already has that connection with Ryan. So
yeah.
I hope for sure one day she makes her way there.
Who is it?
Mrs. Potts, dear.
I thought you might like a spot of tea.
Okay, so let's move on to Spill the Technicolor Tea.
It's like nice to have a little tea party every once in a while.
This is a segment where we talk about any potential controversy or like gossip or just like fun facts in general regarding the project. So, Stefan, what do you have?
There wasn't really a lot of behind the scenes drama.
Yeah.
At least I didn't see. It started out as a sequel to the 1974 film Black Christmas, which, okay, I know Halloween might have kicked off the slasher renaissance, the golden age of slasher films.
Mm-hmm.
But Black Christmas is in a lot of ways the first modern slasher film.
Mm.
It has kind of the concept of the final girl. It originated the killer is coming from the room upstairs trope.
Okay.
5 years before When a Stranger Calls popularized it. That's a good movie. I rewatched that the other night, actually. The first 20 minutes and the last like 20 minutes are really terrifying. There's one shot in the final scene that will stay with you. A lot of it after that in between is just filler, but still recommended. It's still worth it for that alone.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so for me, I have here that nepotism, as you know, it tends to be the case in Hollywood, kind of helped Jamie Lee in a way get the role because, like Stefan mentioned earlier, Jamie Lee Curtis's mom is Janet Lee, who was known for her role in Psycho. And Carpenter knew, I guess, that casting Jamie Lee would be really great publicity for the film. So I was like, interesting.
He considered that the ultimate tribute to Psycho, was to cast her.
And you know what? I've also heard, too, Ryan Murphy say, like, obviously, you know, he cast Jamie Lee based on Mary because she's Jamie Lee Curtis. But Ryan also kind of had that idea in the back of his head, too, when he thought of getting her for Scream Queens. And also, I do remember in an episode of Scream Queens, there is one particular episode where they kind of recreate that psycho shower scene with Jamie Lee. So
that was great.
Yeah.
Ryan Murphy and the boys wrote this into an episode. And I said to them, you know, guys, my whole life I've avoided that. I've literally never stepped in the shower. People have wanted to take my picture, do that. And I've said, no, it's my mom's.
Right.
And that's hers. And it's her legacy. And I said, for this show at this moment, my mom's been gone long enough now. I'm rooted in my own feet.
Yeah. Right.
I think we can now do it.
The timing was right.
Yeah. And we recreated the whole shower scene.
That's amazing.
In the show Scream Queen.
I mean, an additional thing I have here is some fun facts behind the Michael Myers mask. So Tommy Lee Wallace, he was a man of many talents here. He was the production designer, art director, location scout, and co-editor of Halloween. And he made the mask of Michael Myers from a Captain Kirk mask that he bought for $1.98 at a local costume shop on Hollywood Boulevard. And I guess, according to the script, Michael Myers' mask was described as having pale features of a human face. So what he did was he widened the eye holes and spray painted the flesh a bluish white. But that's basically how we got that Michael Myers mask. It's worth noting because that mask is so iconic. Like, you see it all the time. So I just thought it was like, wow, interesting origin story.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I don't know if I finished it when I said, so it started out as the sequel to Black Christmas.
Oh, yeah, sure.
It morphed into its own film during rewrites.
Oh, I see.
A lot of people don't know this, but the director of Black Christmas would go on to direct A Christmas Story.
Oh, interesting.
Uh-huh. So Nick Castle, who played Michael Myers, a.k.a. The Shape,
mm-hmm.
and he's referred to as The Shape just kind of in the script, basically, and it just kind of stuck.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Castle would go on to direct one of my favorite 90s kids movies. I watched it all the time as a kid, Dennis the Menace.
Oh, Dennis the Menace. Okay.
I watched that movie one summer. I swear I watched that movie at least once a week. I loved it.
Wow. That's commitment. Let's see here. I mean, the last piece of tea that I have is the story of the fear meter. Have you heard of this?
I've heard of fear meters before for other movies like William Castle,
mm-hmm.
or ones like in the 50s and 60s. They had something like that where like your blood pressure would be taken.
I mean, I have here that in most cases, I would say pretty much, I'm not going to generalize here, but in most cases, a film or TV show, it's like normally shot out of order. So John Carpenter created this concept and idea of the fear meter as a way to let the actors know like how scared they should be in any given scene. So he would say something like, okay, so this next thing we're about to shoot, it's like about a 6, but later tonight we're going for like a 9.5 on the fear meter. So Jamie Lee Curtis, I guess, had different facial expressions and scream volumes prepared for each level on the fear meter. So it's just like, interesting acting approach there. But do you have any other piece of tea?
I don't know if this is mentioned, but yeah, John Carpenter and Deborah Hill were dating.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And they broke up about a year after the film came out, and Jamie Lee Curtis was just really devastated by that.
It's like nice to have a little tea party every once in a while.
Let's move on to Tinseltown Showdown. Segment where we talk about any potential actors or actresses who may have been up for the role at one point or another. So why don't you go ahead? What do you have?
Yeah, there's really not a lot for this movie. Laurie Strode, the original actress in mind, her name was Anne Lockhart.
Mm-hmm.
She's had a pretty prolific career, nothing really huge. And then Christopher Lee was offered the role of Sam Loomis,
mm-hmm.
but he turned it down due to the low salary.
Right.
And he later said that he deeply regretted that. He called it like the biggest mistake of his career.
Mm-hmm.
Peter Cushing was also considered for the role of Sam Loomis as well, or was offered and also turned it down. And Dennis Quaid, who was dating PJ Souls at the time, who played Linda, he was offered the role of her boyfriend, Bob, but had to turn it down due to other commitments.
No way. I want to see the receipts.
Let's move on to Show Me the Receipts. This is a segment where we talk stats about the movie. So, Stefan, what receipts do you have?
It made $60 to $70 million worldwide on a budget of $325,000, which made it one of the most successful independent films of all time, which even still stands. I mean, what is that?
Crazy.
That ratio that's like 200 to 250 to 1 or something like that on returns.
Yeah, it was incredibly successful, to say the least. I mean, the receipt I have here as well is, I guess it was also nominated for a Saturn Award for Best Horror Film.
And didn't win!
Yes, it lost to The Wicker Man.
And I am confused by this because The Wicker Man was released in 1973.
Oh.
I don't know if it got re-released. That new movie I'm admittedly obsessed with, Midsommar. Midsommar borrows very heavily from The Wicker Man.
Oh, okay.
Christopher Lee is in The Wicker Man since we were just talking about him.
Nice, I like that connection. Additional receipts I have is that it was ranked number 68 on AFI's, that's the American Film Institute, their list of 100 films, 100 thrills. And I guess the Chicago Film Critics Association named Halloween the third scariest film ever made. And then this is a really significant receipt. So in 2006, Halloween was selected for preservation in the United States National Film Registry by the Library of Congress as being, quote, culturally, historically, or aesthetically significant. And not many things get that induction. So that's really, really huge.
I've always wondered, I should research a little more, and I should know this as, you know, a movie buff, what that means to be, you know, registered for preservation. Yeah, I really should. I should know that.
Yeah, I wonder how they qualify or measure. How does something get inducted into this registry?
Yeah.
And then I guess LA Weekly named Michael Myers the greatest villain of all time.
I'd say that's pretty accurate.
Why do you think he is such a good villain?
A lot of people find it creepy that he can't talk. You don't know the motivation initially, even though the sequels do kind of reveal what it was. I mean, the sequels before the new one that came out, which retconned everything. So it's kind of is more creepier, like there wasn't exactly a motive.
Right.
You know, just his height, menacing stature, and, you know, it's the trope kind of where you can catch up despite being so slow.
Yeah.
Which is something in the movie we're going to talk about next week is the antithesis of this.
Okay, so I will definitely have that in the back of my head too.
Yeah.
The last receipt here that I have is the Rotten Tomato score. So Halloween has a 96% on the tomato meter and an 89% audience score.
I'm kind of surprised the audience score isn't higher.
Yeah, me too. I'm expecting at least in the 90s. I mean, it's so close, but yeah.
When a movie hits 90, that's generally considered critical acclaim.
Let's move on to impact and closing thoughts. So, Stefan, what do you think the impact of Halloween is?
I mean, as I mentioned already, it kicked off the golden age of slasher films, which lasted until 1984, produced such gems as Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, the highly underrated The Burning. You probably never heard of that movie.
No.
It was from 1981. Had it been released before Friday the 13th, it would have been the one that people would be talking about and not Friday the 13th. Friday the 13th is not bad, but I kind of don't get why it's such a classic. It really is kind of overrated. And The Burning launched the careers of Holly Hunter, Jason Alexander. For both of them, it was like their first movie or one of them. Unfortunately, launched the career of Harvey Weinstein as well.
Oh, yikes. Okay, well, what I have here is one, it obviously launched Jamie Lee Curtis's career, and she herself has said this, so that's huge.
We made a movie 40 years ago. I was 19 years old. And here I was playing the same character 40 years later in arguably a more successful film than any of the original Halloween movies at the age of 59, coming up on 60.
And then Halloween started out as an independent film, is now like a huge franchise. Like, how many sequels have there been?
Let me pull it up here. If we're counting, and we're counting all of them, including three, which did not have Michael Myers, let's see. Halloween, Halloween 2, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch, Halloween 4, The Return of Michael Myers, Halloween 5, The Revenge of Michael Myers, Halloween, The Curse of Michael Myers, Halloween H2O, 20 Years Later, Halloween Resurrection. That's the one with Tyra Banks and Busta Rhymes, by the way.
Oh, okay, good to know.
And Tyra Banks does not have an on-screen death, which pissed me off.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Halloween and Halloween 2, the Rob Zombie films, don't don't watch those.
Okay.
Halloween 2018. And then there's going to be Halloween Kills and Halloween Ends. So what is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13.
Oh my God. Wow. Well, huge franchise.
Yes. If you want a good kind of homage, there's a downloadable game called Babysitter Bloodbath.
Oh God.
It is a game you can download online for really cheap. It has a real 80s aesthetic to it. It was going to be an official Halloween game, but they couldn't afford the licensing. But it really feels like that. If you don't want to play it, you can just watch a playthrough on YouTube.
I mean, I also have here, aside from huge franchise, that, I mean, every Halloween, it seems that so many people like to dress up as Michael Myers.
Yeah.
The costume, the mask are iconic. The score itself is iconic.
John Carpenter is a genius on so many levels.
Yeah, like one man show, yeah. Truly. And then what I was gonna say earlier when we were talking about the House of Horror scenes was that in 2016 here in California, I went to Halloween Horror Nights at Universal Studios. I did it 1 year.
Oh, jealous. I've always wanted to go to that.
Yeah, and I mean, I mustered up the courage to do it that 1 year because that was the first year they ever had American Horror Story as one of the mazes. I believe that same year they had a house for Halloween. I did not go through the house because I was really scared. I'm a scaredy cat and I was really scared, but I do remember like walking through the section, like you could hear the Halloween score. So, you know, kind of like you were talking about with the game playthroughs on YouTube, they do have the videos up on YouTube of people walking through the houses.
I've always loved being scared. I've loved like roller coasters as a kid, as a really little kid.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, fear, it's an adrenaline rush. There's enough to be scared of in the world as is that are legit real fears. And right. Horror touches on that too, you know, subconsciously. And that's why I love horror, is it deals with like societal fears as a backdrop to supernatural fears. And I think the recent Jordan Peele movies do that very well. They touch, you know, our fears of race and class. And those are true fears. Like, you know, one of my favorite quotes was, it's not gore that scares, but uncomfortable truths. That is what is truly terrifying.
What do you think then the uncomfortable truth is? Or fear is in Halloween?
You know, plays on kind of the fears of small town
lore
in a lot of ways, like the boogeyman.
Right.
You know, the house you don't go to. And they reference that, you know, the abandoned house or whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah, they reference that in there. One reason why the 80s is such an iconic decade for horror, it was a paranoid decade.
Mm-hmm.
AIDS hysteria. The Satanic Panic. Oh my God. That's a whole, we could do a whole episode on that. Do you know about the Satanic Panic?
No.
So it was where like the whole moral majority was really starting, you know, the Save Our Children campaign kind of was spreading around the country, even though they were defeated in California. Flashback to our Milk episode.
Yeah.
Back in the 80s and early 90s, a wave of troubling accusations swept across North America.
New and intense scrutiny on the activities of satanic cults.
Stories of devil worship and satanic cults corrupting young minds.
Unbelievable crime at the hands of satanic cults.
There were terrifying tales of secret satanic cults bent on tormenting and corrupting the young. Heavy metal music had hidden satanic messages.
Possibly satanic messages on some rock music recordings.
And games like Dungeons and Dragons were luring kids to devil worship. And it got even stranger.
Allegations of physical and sexual abuse of children at a babysitting service.
The dark world of ritualistic child abuse.
There's a widely held opinion that what happened at the daycare was the devil's handiwork.
Underground networks of Satanists were infiltrating daycares and preschools to physically and sexually abuse children in occult rituals. Much of what fueled the panic was not real. But these claims led to a wave of high-profile criminal trials in the U.S., Canada, and beyond.
And the FBI later proved it was untrue, but people had their lives ruined. They were fired from their jobs. There was a famous murder case, the West Memphis Three.
It's a case so stunning, so controversial, it became a major cause célèbre.
with actors and musicians like Johnny Depp, the Dixie Chicks' Natalie Maines, and Pearl Jam's Eddie Vedder.
I'm also here to show my support for the West Memphis Three.
Speaking out for the defendants, three little Cub Scouts, hog-tied and left in an Arkansas ditch, and three teenagers, enamored with satanic rituals, arrested. It made headlines all over the country, even becoming the subject of three HBO documentaries called Paradise Lost.
We were like really the obvious choice because we stood out.
I didn't kill these three little boys.
The celebrities fighting for the teens' release claimed the kids were railroaded because of their mullets, dark clothes, and fascination with the occult.
And I feel like right now, in the 2010s, we're at another resurgence of horror because of the real-life paranoia and horrors of the world today.
Coming soon to theaters.
All right, everybody. We have now come to coming attractions. I'm going to be playing a clip from the movie that we're talking about next week. As Stefan referenced throughout this entire episode, this is a great movie to be talking about right after Halloween. So let's see if you guys can figure this one out.
You like scary movies?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite scary movie?
I don't know.
You have to have a favorite. What comes to mind?
Halloween.
Well, I mean, do you have any other things you wanted to say about Halloween before I let you go?
No, I think that's all.
Hopefully you guys enjoyed this episode. It's our first one in our Halloween Divas series that we're doing for the month of October. Stefan, where can the people find you if they want to, you know, hit you up more on all things horror and Halloween?
Yeah, you can find me on Scream Forever 1 on Twitter.
Nice. And if you want to follow the podcast, we're at Diva Dailies Pod on Twitter and Instagram. You can also email us divadailiespod@gmail.com, or you can also leave us a voicemail. We're 714-729-3121. And then if you want to follow me personally on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at INN_MHO. And then you can also find me on YouTube in My Humble Opinion. That is pretty much it. Thank you so much for joining me again, Stefan, on this one.
Always a pleasure, Steffi.
Yes, and then, well, Stefan will be back next week to cover our next horror movie for October.
I'm really excited for this one next week, not gonna lie.
Well, until then, as we always say here on the podcast, remember, divas.
So the thing is, a diva has to be good at what she does.